Welcome to the Intuitive Awakening Podcast. I'm your host, Deanna Riddick. I'm an author, teacher, and eternal seeker of truth. I am on a mission to spread metaphysical knowledge to everyone in an effort to help them awaken to universal truth. If you want to learn about spirituality, the occult, and all things related to metaphysics, you are in the right place. Hi everyone, welcome to Intuitive Awakening. My name is Dina. Thank you for joining me for this week's episode. Over the next few months or so, including today, I'm going to be discussing the Divine Feminine and what this concept entails. Specifically, I've spent quite a bit of time reviewing the Gnostic Gospels, looking at archaeological evidence and literature, reviewing religious history worldwide to guide my understanding. And I'll spend quite a bit of time examining goddesses from various cultures to really bring their stories and their messages of empowerment, strength, beauty, resilience, even their divine rage, their compassion, essentially their personal gnosis to light. But first, let's kind of begin this episode with what the Divine Feminine really is. This is something that you've seen probably trending everywhere, like reclaim your inner goddess, reclaim the Divine Feminine within you. It is quite a trendy word, but what is it exactly? And the definition that I have, I wonder whether or not it actually is in alignment with what you've seen or what you've heard as being the Divine Feminine. So the Divine Feminine is the spiritual notion that there exists a feminine counterpart to the patriarchal and masculine structures that have long dominated organized religions. The current emphasis on the Divine Feminine is an attempt to redress gendered spiritual imbalance, which is a result of this patriarchal colonial approach to gender, where the feminine energy, or feminine spirit if you will, has been devalued and almost completely eliminated. It's important to mention here what patriarchy is, since I've used that word twice. Patriarchy is an ideology and system of oppression where power is held by men because men are seen as superior. Because of this system of oppression, there was virtually an obliteration of feminine power, I would say feminine expression, and feminine wisdom. And as many of you are aware, matrilineal societies, they existed in the past, and a lot of that has been discovered primarily through archaeological evidence. We know that goddesses were worshipped as sources of power, wisdom, light, authority across the world, and we see goddesses worshipped in places like ancient Italy, Greece, Africa, Egypt, India, where goddesses are still worshipped there. And over the coming months, I'm going to be focusing on bringing, like I said earlier, the Divine Feminine Gnosis to the forefront by exploring their stories across the world. And I think it's really important to use the word Gnosis here. Energy is appropriate, but Gnosis is an inner knowing, which we can say is also wisdom. And I think that if we approach the Divine Feminine as a source of wisdom, it's useful for us in that way. It can teach us something, which is what spirituality is also supposed to be, a process of learning and a process of always becoming. And that's how we can, I think that approaching the Divine Feminine in that way contributes to our own personal gnosis. So what is masculine energy? Masculine energy is considered the active principle. It takes action. It's assertive, it's very direct. It's focused on doing rather than being. It's the side of your being that is responsible for taking decisive action. Some of the additional traits of masculine energy includes logic, reason, survival, loyalty, and rationality, just to name a few. But what's the divine masculine? So the divine masculine, it's the energy of action, but one that is open, one that is loving, one that you could probably say is a faith-based action. In this type of energy, the divine masculine listens to the divine feminine's knowing. It receives her divine intuitive downloads and then acts upon that with faith. This is the energy that unites the world in love and peace and personal authority, allowing all beings and all things to have a seat at the table of, let's call it, oneness. When this energy manifests with conflict and control, fear has clearly taken the reins, and that's what we kind of call, or what has been called, the wounded masculine. The wounded side comes from an energy of proving, one of struggling, achieving to prove worthiness, and feeling fear of not being loved or welcomed enough. Before I continue, you guys, there, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, The Birds. I think it's like an Alfred Hitchcock movie, an old one, but for some reason in my area, the birds are out and it sounds just like the movie when they're like tearing people's eyes out. So I'm sorry if you hear a lot of birds in the background, as I'm talking. I digress, but that's important to mention in case you think I'm making some strange noises on the side. I'm not. All right, so what is the feminine energy? Feminine energy is traditionally defined as passive energy or receptive energy. It encompasses intuition, healing, gentleness, wisdom, patience, compassion, the emotions, empathy, renewal, and fertility or growth, which can be spiritual, emotional, physical. It also encompasses forgiveness, nurturing, etc. Now, each and every one of us are a mix of both masculine and feminine energies. And, you know, we are experiencing and have been experiencing a major imbalance between the masculine and feminine energies, especially here in the Western world, but really arguably almost across the entire planet. We have leaned way too far in the direction of the masculine. Now, again, back to this concept of the wounded masculine. You know, the wounded masculine learns early in life to suppress pain and deny its woundedness. Instead, it projects its wounds into the world onto some sort of external enemy, fighting endless wars rooted in religious intolerance and racism and other forms of inequality. It uses intellect and brute force to dominate and control. It measures its worth in monetary terms and power over others. The wounded masculine always has a point to prove, and it will go to extraordinary lengths to prove it. And, you know, it'll go to such extraordinary lengths. This can, you know, end in death and destruction, etc. And again, this is where there's a perversion of the divine masculine energy that creates conflict, violence, unhealthy competition, which has been playing out on the world stage for quite a bit of time. And now it is time to tip the scales by, if we want to say, reclaiming the divine feminine. And this reclamation is really occurring in this day and age. And we have seen this in the Time's Up movement, the Me Too movement, and third wave feminism, where we recognize how gender intersects with race, class, religion, politics, education, environmental injustice, etc. In spirituality, there has been a concerted effort to reclaim the voice, the perspective, the energy, and the wisdom of the divine feminine. And the divine feminine is needed to rebalance social and political spaces and even educational spaces. The feminine is needed to create a more balanced and supportive society, an empathetic society, a compassionate society, and even an intuitive society. We can harness the divine feminine energies to transform ourselves and our community, and of course the world at large. Hopefully by incorporating and embodying this divine feminine energy, it can help to heal a dangerous world that is lacking in love in a lot of places. Now, there are many divine archetypes that we're going to be exploring over the coming months, which include but are not necessarily limited to the goddess, the priestess slash mystic, the healer, the wise woman or sage, the witch, the lover, the warrior huntress, the queen slash empress, the destroyer, the mother, and the maiden. The exciting news is that the long dormant energies of the divine feminine are awakening.
And my goal by discussing this is not to only teach, but of course, it's to learn about, you know, the sacred feminine consciousness and what it has to teach us all. Now, this brings me to the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. I'm not really sure how many of you have read this gospel or have even heard of it, but I definitely wanted to include Mary Magdalene in our efforts to reclaim or even recover the divine feminine. Now, in her own right, the archetypes of the priestess, in my opinion, belong to Mary Magdalene. Many of you are most likely familiar with Mary Magdalene, the prostitute, which is a false story, but maybe not Mary Magdalene, the apostle of apostles, as she is known. The suppression of Mary's role and her true wisdom was intentionally done by the Catholic Church, which we are going to discuss today. But first, let's just talk about the Mary that we're familiar with. So what we actually do know about Mary comes from the canonical Gospels. Number one, she's the only woman besides Mother Mary who is mentioned by name in all four synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We know that Jesus frees her of seven demons. She is also one who waits at the foot of the cross during Christ's crucifixion. And we know that she is the first to see Jesus resurrected from the tomb. And it is because of this that she is considered the Apostle of Apostles. Now, as you're aware, Mary Magdalene's identity was assigned to a prostitute, which actually comes from the 33rd homily of Pope Gregory I in the year 591, in which he pretty much just declares that she is the unnamed woman in Luke, or she and the unnamed woman in Luke are in fact one and the same, just point blank. So I'm gonna read what he says specifically. So per this Pope, she whom Luke calls the sinful woman, whom John calls Mary, we believe to be the Mary from whom seven devils signify, if not all the vices. It is clear, brothers, that the woman previously used the unguent to perfume her flesh in forbidden acts. So pretty much he is declaring that Mary Magdalene is this prostitute. The end. However, the Greek word sinner in the verse of Luke, which the Pope is referring to, is amartolos, which can actually be translated many ways. From a Jewish perspective, it could be one who has transgressed Jewish law. It might also mean someone who did not pay his or her taxes. The word does not imply a prostitute whatsoever. The Greek word for harlot is porin, which is used elsewhere in Luke. But it is not used for the sinful woman who weeps at Jesus' feet. In fact, there is no direct reference to her or to Mary as a prostitute anywhere in the Gospels. It is super important to note here that in 1969, the Catholic Church officially repealed the Pope's labeling of Mary as a whore, and they admitted their error. So, if Mary is not the prostitute, then who is she? We know of Mary not only from the Bible, but also from the Gnostic Gospels, which were rejected by the Roman Catholic Church. The suppression of early Christian literature began when Constantine became emperor of Rome and declared Christianity the religion of the entire Roman Empire, leading to a process of conversion that occurred over a lot of years, really across the world, right? In 325, Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea, where it was decided which texts would become the standards of the church and which ones would be suppressed. Those that were not chosen as the standard were attacked for many years. Even the bishops of the Council of Nicaea were exiled on the spot. Now, the Gospel of Mary was found in the Berlin Gnostic Codex in the late 19th century in Upper Egypt. It was purchased in Cairo in 1896 by a German scholar, and then it was taken to Berlin. The codex was probably copied and bound in the late 4th or early 5th century. It contains Coptic translations of three very important early Christian Gnostic texts: the Gospel of Mary, the Apocryphon of John, and the Sophia of Jesus Christ. The texts themselves date to the 2nd century, and they were originally authored in Greek. Now, despite the importance of the discovery of this ancient collection of Gnostic scriptures, several misfortunes, including two world wars, delayed its publication until 1955. In 1945, at Nag Hammadi in Egypt, some texts were found in clay jars. The contents of these jars have come to be known as the Gnostic Gospels because of the association of many of them with their belief system of a group who called themselves Gnostics. And this comes from the Greek word gnosis, meaning inner knowing, self-acquaintance, or even self-knowledge. So in all, 13 leather-bound papyrus codices were found. The writings in these codices comprise 52 mostly Gnostic treaties. Now, the codex preserves the most complete surviving fragment of the Gospel of Mary. And it is clear that this person named Mary is the person that we call Mary of Magdala. Two other fragments of the Gospel of Mary from separate Greek editions were later unearthed in archaeological excavations in Egypt. Now, finding three fragments of a text of this antiquity, it's extremely unusual. And it is evidenced that the Gospel of Mary was well distributed in early Christian times, and it existed in both an original Greek and a Coptic language translation. Now, I did want to mention that in addition to the Gospel, there are two other writings that bear the name. There was one called the Questions of Mary, and this was mentioned by Epiphanes, and he was the bishop of Cyrus at the end of the 4th century. And he's best known for composing the Panarion, and this is a very large compendium of heresies. They're full of quotations, and there are only surviving fragments of suppressed texts. Now, what's important here is that these two writings that include Mary's name, one of them was called The Questions of Mary, and the other one was called The Birth of Mary. And again, Epiphanes kind of references them in his compendium that he creates, but we don't have these surviving texts, unfortunately. It would be very interesting to see what's in them. Now, the only thing that we know about the Questions of Mary, it was a gospel featuring Mary Magdalene and a very strange encounter that she had with Jesus. Really, it was about their sexual encounter, so that was pretty interesting. And then there's the Birth of Mary. We don't have that either, so we don't really know. But we know that the Gospel of Mary Magdalene was very well circulated during the time, and many people knew of her, and many people knew of what was written in this gospel in particular. So now, I am going to read to you some bits and pieces of the Gospel of Mary. It's actually quite short, given that we're missing quite a few pages. It would be so amazing if we had the entire text, because the spots that are missing, I feel like, are really crucial details. It's almost like it was intentional in a way. Maybe, maybe not. But I'm going to read to you some of the text, and then we're going to try to understand slash analyze what's going on here. But I'm also very curious to get your thoughts on this gospel. Like, if you're really interested in reading it, you can actually find it online for free. Like I said, it's virtually short, but there are also some great books that I read before I did this episode because I wanted to try to get the most understanding and give you guys a more comprehensive view as I was putting everything together. And I will put all of those in the notes section or description section. So I have a ton of notes. There's so many pages. Okay, so I'm going to start off. Let me pull this up for the beginning. It's definitely very different than what you're probably thinking it's going to be. If you've read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, then you probably have an assumption of what Jesus is going to say here. But really what's happening in this text, because we're jumping into the middle, we're missing the first pages 1-6 of this gospel. So we're really starting here technically on page 7, where there's this interesting conversation where the disciples are asking, you know, what is matter? That's the question. What is matter? Will it last forever? The teacher answered, all that is born, all that is created, all the elements of nature are interwoven and united with each other. All that is composed shall be decomposed. Everything returns to its roots. Matter returns to the origins of matter. Those who have ears, let them hear. Now, just to give you a little bit of background here, what's happening is that it's really Mary Magdalene who you can say that Jesus is speaking through. So for our modern terms, she's a channeler, right? The spirit of Jesus is literally, his words are coming through her. So she's acting kind of as this channel slash intermediary, answering the questions of the disciples. Peter said to him, since you have become the interpreter of the elements and the events of the world, tell us, what is the sin of the world? The teacher answered, there is no sin. It is you who make sin exist when you act according to the habits of your corrupted nature. This is where sin lies. This is why the good has come into your midst. It acts together with the elements of your nature so as to reunite it with its roots. Then he continued, this is why you become sick and why you die. It is the result of your actions. What you do takes you further away. Those who have ears, let them hear. So again, one of the first topics that is addressed is this whole issue of matter, which is really interesting, right? Because this is very metaphysical in nature. And the apostles are asking, you know, is matter permanent? What is it? And here you have the teacher pretty much stating that everything that is created, all the elements of nature, everything is connected and everything is united together, woven together. This is true of everything here, essentially, in this world. So he's responding very strongly that the origin of nature, the material world, does not lie within this earthly plane. What we take for reality, in which everything is interwoven, will cease to be. Meaning that everything is subject to decomposition. Nothing lasts forever. What has a beginning will have an ending. And the whole idea of impermanence is super important here. All matter returns to the origins of matter, and we see this pattern in nature as well. So after talking about this, you know, you have Peter then asking about sin. What is sin, and what is the sin of the world? And, you know, very much so unlike what we find in the Synoptic Gospels, he responds here, there is no sin. It is you who make sin exists when you act according to the habits of your corrupted nature. This is where sin lies. What does he mean by this exactly? Sin is not inherent in things, nor is it some element of the cosmos, nor of human nature. It is definitely found in the way human nature is translated. And if we look at the etymology of the Greek word for sin, which is hamartia or hamartia, the word actually means to miss the mark. So perhaps here, sinning is a misperception of a reality. When you act according to what you believe is reality, you miss the mark. Next, he says, when you act according to the habits of your corrupted nature, this is where sin lies. So how is corruption defined here? And corruption begins when you identify yourself with your body, which is matter that shall be decomposed at some point. People forgo their spiritual natures and they succumb to the passions of their bodies and the world. But he reassures his disciples that this is why the good has come. Now remember this, that the word gospel literally translates to the good news. Literally. Right, this is why the good news has come for you, to teach you, quote unquote, the way, to inform you, to make you aware. Perhaps what he is saying here is that I've come to bring the good news to help you reunite yourself with your roots and to free you from your ignorance. Perhaps reunite you with the source or reunite you with the truth of your being. So next he explains, you know, the reason why we're sick and why we die is because we continue to live in ignorance, right? And because we have a disordered perception, therefore we act in ways that distance us from the source. But also it's our attachment to matter, the material world, right? Our attachment to this material world that contributes to our corrupted nature. It is our attachments and our passions that are against nature. It seems that he is saying that it is not in our true nature to attach ourselves to that which we know is transitory, that which we know is impermanent. To think that we can really possess any object or person or even our own bodies is an illusion. And this illusion is the cause of trouble. All right. So now I'm going to read to you the next passage that is in the gospel. So he says next, impose no law other than that which I have witnessed. Do not add more laws to those given in the Torah, lest you become bound by them. Having said all this, he departed. The disciples were in sorrow, shedding many tears and saying, how are we to go among the unbelievers and announce the gospel of the kingdom of the Son of Man? They didn't spare his life, so why should they spare ours? Then Mary arose, embraced them all, and began to speak to her brothers. Do not remain in sorrow and doubt, for his grace will guide you and comfort you. Instead, let us praise his greatness, for he has prepared us for this. He is calling upon us to become fully human, or what is really said here in this text, fully anthropos, and we'll get to that in a minute. Thus Mary turned their hearts toward the good, and they began to discuss the meaning of the teacher's words. So the disciples are pretty disturbed by the information that they're hearing. Some of the messages are very different from what they were kind of told before. At least it's different from how they understood his original teachings. So in this gospel, it reads that the disciples were in sorrow, shedding many tears and saying, how are we to go amongst the unbelievers and announce the gospel of the kingdom? They didn't spare his life, so why should they spare ours? And then you have Mary, who's letting them know, embracing them all, comforting them. You know, don't remain in sorrow and don't remain in doubt. It is clearly Mary who is the true believer, while everyone else was in fear. She was steadfast in her beliefs, and she comforted the rest of the disciples. And she had a deep understanding of the rabbi's teachings, and she was not afraid. As Mary Magdalene steps forward to encourage them, she demonstrates that she has fully understood what Jesus is saying and can apply it to her own life. And she reminds them very pointedly, he's prepared us for this already. Now, it's interesting in this gospel because we find, as you'll see, that the disciples believed that the teacher loved her more and loved her differently from other women. Many have speculated that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were together as man and wife, and it is slightly insinuated in this gospel as well. The disciples ask her, you know, in this gospel, if the teacher happened to tell her anything that he didn't share with them because of the nature of their relationship. And Mary does have a message for them, really. She had a vision where she was given some information by Jesus. So I'm going to read that to you now. Peter said to Mary, "Sister, we know that the teacher loved you differently from other women. Tell us whatever you remember of any words he told you, which we have not yet heard." Mary said to them, "I will now speak to you of that which has not been given to you to hear. I had a vision of the teacher, and I said to him, 'Lord, I see you now in this vision.' And he answered, 'You are blessed, for the sight of me does not disturb you. There where is the noose lies the treasure. Then I said to him, Lord, when someone meets you in a moment of vision, is it through the soul that they are seeing, or is it through the spirit? Now, the word soul originally is the word psyche, which is used here. The word spirit is the pneuma. So I'll be talking about those in a bit. The teacher answered, it is neither through the soul nor the spirit, but the noose between the two, which sees the vision, and it is this which... We're missing so many pages after that, which is so important. We're missing like five freaking pages, you guys, because there's so many questions that I have from that. And I think a lot of scholars in general, when I was doing research, they were like, wait a minute, what? So let's talk a little bit about this, because she's clearly asking them, how is it that I'm able to see you? You know, am I seeing you through the soul, through the psyche, or am I seeing you through the spirit? She's just really wondering, how is it even possible? And he says, it is the noose between the two which sees the vision. What does he mean? What is the noose? In Greek, the word noose is defined as the divine mind, the divine intelligence, but really the divine mind. So in the Gospel of Mary, it's the noose, the divine mind. It's the intermediary between the realm of the psyche, or the soul, and the realm of the pneuma, the spirit. It is the pneuma, which is also known as the breath, or the Holy Spirit, that is considered as truly divine. The pneuma is the spirit of God. Thus, accordingly, each human being is a composite body, or a soma. They're a soul, which is the psyche. They are the mind, which is the nous, and the spirit, which is the pneuma. The pneuma is not itself a component of the human complex, however, but the reality that gives life to other components. So in this perspective, to become spiritual is not to disincarnate, nor is it to deny our feelings and emotions. Instead, spiritualization is a process of imbuing these different dimensions of the human being with the presence of the pneuma. This transfigures the body, expands and calms the soul, and it simplifies and clarifies the mind and the spirit. So according to the Gospel of Mary, it is precisely this nous, this higher mind, divine mind, that receives the pneuma, the spirit of God, and transmits its fire and light to all the other elements of the human complex. By accessing the nous, the divine mind, she is able to see the teacher and communicate. Now, if we remember, he also says, there where is the nous lies the treasure. Does anything about this ring a bell? This one little phrase. These exact words have often been quoted in later Christian writings. There where is the nous lies the treasure. We see this in the writings of Clement of Alexandria and many others, which again is evidence that the Gospel of Mary was widely circulated during the first centuries of Christianity. So it's important to remember that the nous has no such place in the Gospels of Luke and Matthew. Instead, there's a word substitute here, right? For where your treasure is, there your heart will also be. Does that ring a bell? Very similar to, there where is the nous lies the treasure. We find that statement, for where your treasure is, there your heart will also be, in Luke and in Matthew. So in this gospel, Mary really proclaims that the true spiritual treasure is to be found within the mind, within the divine mind, which is the medium for spiritual sight. The discovery of one's true spiritual self is found within, by orienting the mind towards the soul. Now, I'm not going to really be covering the entire gospel here, line by line, but I also wanted to, I feel like I would do the whole gospel a disservice if I didn't mention the fact that there is an entire section devoted to Mary, where she explains the ascension of the soul through what are called climates, right? She uses that word climates. There are four emotional climates. The first one is darkness. The second one is craving. The last one is ignorance. Or the third one, excuse me, is ignorance. And the last state comprises seven forms that oppress the soul. So these seven adverse states are as follows. Darkness, craving, ignorance, lethal jealousy, enslavement to the flesh, intoxicated wisdom, and finally, cunning wisdom. Those psychic climates are known as the seven manifestations of wrath in Mary's gospel. Those negative tendencies are human adverse emotional states that block the path of the soul, and they're often pretty well developed. So her short message here delineates how to find spiritual liberation by transcending these adverse psychic tendencies. Now, here's the thing I need to tell you. If you haven't looked at the gospel, you have to note that we're missing some pages here as well. So there's likely, you know, more climates that we're missing in this section. When you open up the gospel, it's in the middle of this conversation about liberating the soul and moving through these climates, but we clearly have missed the beginning of that discussion. Now, again, in this vision, you know, someone asks the soul whether it comes as a slayer of men or where it's going. And the soul responds that it is no longer bound. Desire has ended. Ignorance has died. It has been released from the world. And from this time on, I will attain to the rest of time of the season of the eon in silence. And at which point Mary then falls silent. So all of this is included in this section of the Ascension of the Soul. If you're really interested, I highly recommend you read it. You may need to read it a few times. It's pretty detailed and deep, but it's very interesting that she brings this to us, like how to liberate our souls. Okay. So one message that we see throughout this gospel, time and time again, is about becoming fully human. So technically, you know, Jesus says this a few times, you know, to become fully anthropos is the word, which means human. In one of the passages she says, he is calling upon us to become fully human or fully anthropos. And then again, let us atone and become fully anthropos. What does this mean in the gospel? To become fully human. So to become fully human is, yes, a modern translation of the words to become an anthropos, a completed human being. So both here and even in the Gospel of Thomas is this notion, you know, at the very heart of Jesus's vision of transformation. Now I'm going to read you from Catherine Bergeault, because I think that she sums things up much better than I could for this whole concept of anthropos to become fully human. So the concept of anthropos is generally interpreted in terms of an integration of the opposites within oneself, specifically a bringing together of the male and female principles within the individual. The union of opposites that Jesus is speaking of pertains to the union of the finite and the infinite within oneself, or the bringing together of the vertical axis with the horizontal, so that there is one heart, one being, one will, one God, all in all. When this happens, the world does not pass away, but one is able to live in it as a master, recreating its external forms out of the infinite generativity of the one. It's important to keep this definition of the anthropos in mind because it's really the key to everything in this gospel. Mary Magdalene, she moves among the other disciples as one who has already become fully anthropos, one who has already become fully human. And she doesn't merely just kind of parrot the master's teachings back to them. Rather, she's serving the situation. All right, so now I'm going to read you a passage because I think this is really important where, again, you know, Mary is being doubted by her brothers. Then Andrew began to speak and said to his brothers, "Tell me, what do you think of these things that she's been telling us? As for me, I do not believe that the teacher would speak like this. These ideas are too different from those we have known." And Peter added, "How is it possible that the teacher talked in this manner with a woman about secrets of which we ourselves are ignorant?" Must we change our customs and listen to this woman? Did he really choose her and prefer her to us? Then Mary wept and answered him, "My brother Peter, what can you be thinking? Do you believe that this is just my own imagination, that I invented this vision? Or do you believe that I would lie about our teacher?" At this, Levi spoke up, "Peter, you have always been hot-tempered, and now we see you repudiating a woman just as our adversaries do. Yet if the teacher held her worthy, who are you to reject her? Surely the teacher knew her very well, for he loved her more than us. Therefore, let us atone and become fully anthropos, so that the teacher can take root in us. Let us grow as he demanded of us and walk forth to spread the gospel without trying to lay down any rules and laws other than those he witnessed." We see in this gospel that it is Mary who had the understanding of the teachings. She was also, you know, a comforter. She shored up the strength of the other disciples, and she was intermediary in a way. I think that Mary certainly fulfills the archetype of the priestess. Now, a priestess is a woman who is authorized to perform the sacred rites of a religion, but she's also regarded as a leader, really a leader of a movement for which, you know, she spread the movement of Christianity. She also had the gift of spiritual sight because she was able to see Jesus, which did not frighten her. She was able to see him when the others could not. It's not only in the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, but in the other texts, such as the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip, which are part of the Nag Hammadi collection, we get to see Mary as an active and a very vocal participant. She speaks frequently, and she acts as a representative of the disciples as a group, addressing several questions to Jesus. She is included amongst the special disciples to whom Jesus entrusted his most elevated teaching. We see this not only here, but we also see this in other Gnostic texts, the Dialogue of the Savior and the PistSophia. And I'm going to cover those later, all right? So as we see here in the Gospel of Mary, Peter simply cannot accept Mary's leadership or the revelations that she is bringing from the risen Christ. Now, I'm going to read to you something from Isabella Price because I think she does a really great job of explaining this. So Peter and Mary, according to Isabella, represent two distinctive approaches to the good news of the Christian story. While Peter grasps the fundamental tenets of the faith, holding them as historical facts, it's Mary who is in constant communion with the Christ and is the recipient of ongoing revelation directly communicated from heart to heart in silence, which again, if you go back to the text, she states explicitly, it is stated in there that it is in a state of silence that she is able to receive the messages coming from the Christ. Yet in the end, it was Peter who became the rock upon which the monolithic institutional church emerged, modeled after the strict hierarchy and patriarchal structures of the Roman Empire. The unbroken chain between Peter, who later became the Bishop of Rome, and the Pope, served as the theological foundation for the apostolic succession that is the cornerstone of ministry and authority in the very church today. The apostles had come to be seen exclusively as male. As we cover, you know, these various texts over the next few months, you're going to see that Jesus's inner circle includes both men and women on an equal footing. And Mary Magdalene is clearly in this inner circle and probably at the very top, if you will. Mary Magdalene is seen as first amongst the apostles. And this is not because she happens to be the first to witness the resurrection, but because she understands the true meaning of the rabbi's teachings. So what happened to Mary Magdalene? What happened after all of this? Well, if you know anything about Mary Magdalene, there was a devout following of her, which arose around the 11th century, and it really, you know, continues to this day. So according to the local legend of Saint Marie de la Mer in France, Mary Magdalene and two other Marys arrived in a boat having set sail from Alexandria, Egypt. This was after the death of Jesus. They brought with them the teachings of Jesus, and they helped to spread his message in France. So at the very end of this gospel, they all, you know, it says explicitly that they all went forth to spread the gospel, or to go spread the good news. The end. So as you know, we're missing quite a few pages of this gospel, which I think would have been super insightful. But, you know, what we have today is very helpful for understanding. You guys, I really hope that you've enjoyed this episode today. It took a lot of reading and a lot of putting stuff together. I will put book recommendations in the show notes. And again, if you want to learn more about Mary Magdalene, I think, you know, the best source really is to read her gospel, is to really understand her role amongst the disciples, to really understand why this gospel was completely suppressed. Again, if you even listen to the words that are being used, the language is quite different than what you would find in the Bible. Imagine that all of a sudden Jesus is like, wait a minute, there's no sin. That would go against, you know, what is actually in the New Testament. I think that it's important, as I kind of stated at the beginning, to revisit a lot of these, if we could call it again, this divine feminine gnosis, this knowledge that's resurfacing. And it is resurfacing because I think we understand now, probably understood a long time ago as well, but now there is an energy that is present. There is an opportunity for us to not only reclaim this, but to embody it, to balance the energy that is here on the planet, to make it a more compassionate place, to make it a more empathic place, to make it a more loving place. Thank you guys for listening to this episode, and I look forward to reviewing some other texts with you in the coming weeks. Take care, be safe. Bye-bye.